Previously on 24.
Tony, you got a second?
What is it?
I think it's time I step down. Here you go.
What's this?
Access codes to CTU and division. You're the new CTU director, Tony.
You're gonna let me out of here right now. I know the bomb didn't go off.
I just wanted some company, that's all.
Then what are you doing out here?
This is where I belong.
I don't.
Here, take it. There's cougars out there. If you see one, fire a shot in the air and they'll take off.
I just spoke with Roger Stanton. He confesses that he's known about the bomb for weeks.
You have to trust me, David. Your presidency is in jeopardy. Let me help you.
No. You'll leave now. If you resist in any way, I'll have no choice but to place you under arrest.
You gotta give me your badge, Kate.
No. I don't believe you'd shoot me.
Where's the bomb, Marie? The real bomb.
You can go to hell, you bastard. I'm not telling you anything.
Why do you want me and my team to leave here so fast? Bomb's still here, isn't it, Marie?
Teams A and B, I want you to initiate a grid search on every outbuilding at the airport, starting at the north end, headed south. The bomb is on site. I repeat, the bomb is on site.
It's armed.
How much time have we got?
I can't tell. Could be any second.
The following takes place between 10 p.m. and 11 p.m.
Is this Bob Cochran, co-creator, executive producer, and author of this episode?
And this is Xander Berkeley, and I play George Mason.
We're on the stage of 24, and if you hear any sounds in the background, buzzing and sawing and hammering away, it's because our crew is putting together sets for the next show.
I thought those bomb boys did a great job of creating the reality of...
Yeah, they did. The prop guys did a lot of research and made sure the bomb looked real and matched up with how we described it in dialogue. And the dialogue was also a research. We called some of the L.A. bomb guys and said, what kind of stuff do you say and what kind of obstacles could there be? And they were very cooperative. I think the key here is everybody in the audience expects they're going to defuse the bomb just in time. And setting up those kinds of expectations and then thwarting them is a big part of what the show's about.
It worked. We're in good shape.
Good.
Similarly, there's an expectation that I'm not going to come on the show from the last time exit CTU, so it's a reveal here.
Yeah, there it is.
George, what are you doing here? This is the thing that killed me, Jack. I'd kind of like to be here when they lay it to rest. You got it diffused yet?
No, not yet. They're looking at about 10 minutes.
Is there a timer?
It's internal. I haven't been able to read it yet.
So theoretically, it could detonate at any minute.
George, they've got it under control. Come on, there's got to be somewhere else you'd rather be.
I promised myself I was going to see this through to the end. That's what I'm going to do.
And Xander just did a great job of deteriorating over the course of the season. And he really convinces you that he's going through hell.
Part of the process of creating that reality is they let me do my own makeup, and that's something I've done since I was a kid as an actor, and it's a way of getting inside the character's reality. If you can watch it, you gradually assimilate it internally as you're developing it externally.
I should have seen it, but it was disguised. If it's dismantled or disconnected from the main casing, it'll detonate.
Are you telling me that there is no way to disarm this bomb?
That's what I'm telling you.
This is originally the first act break. And in the editing room, we decided to take some stuff out of the first act and play right through to a later act break, and you'll see it. But I think it quickened the pace quite a bit of the first act, which was good.
Get it.
I did research from the beginning, knowing that I'd inhaled the plutonium and read what was written about what the known effects would be.
How much time have we got?
55. That's a tough thing about our show. We spend a lot of time making the audience really invest in characters, and then we kill them. That's just the deal. But I think that's one of the things that makes it edgy and in some ways hard to watch, but in other ways it really makes it feel anything can happen on this show.
Yeah, that's right.
Now here's a place I think where here comes in a second this scuzzbag is going to come along and try to give her a ride. Not these two, but the next guy. And everything, is this idiot's going to get in the car again? Because people feel like she gets herself in trouble all the time. But didn't turn out that way.
Need a ride?
Where are you going?
Well, where are you trying to get to?
San Jose.
Oh, no kidding. That's right where I'm headed.
Well, Santa Clara, actually. It's just a few minutes past San Jose.
You know what? That's okay. I'm fine, thanks.
Don't be scared.
I'm not.
Well, then get in. There's no point wandering around here in the middle of the night.
I'll be fine.
One second you need to get a ride to San Jose, the next you don't.
I'm sorry. It's really nice that you pulled over. It's just that I...
This is great. Here's where she stands up for herself in a way that we haven't seen before and shows that she's not dumb and she's not, not an idiot. This guy's the idiot.
Get back in the car and keep driving.
We go through there's no counting over and over again in terms of not just get the script right, but for in and of itself, but to make it flow from what's before it and make it go into what's coming up. It's just a constant process. Can't even count the rewrites. In the meantime, prepare for the two possibilities we discussed. The boxes originally came about because in the very first episode of the first season, we had so many cell phone calls that we were very concerned because a lot of times phone calls are just boring on screen. And the director and the editor... Stephen Hopkins and Dave Thompson came up with the idea of splitting the screen for the phone calls, which worked well for the phone calls, and then we realized it can work for anything. We like transitions and emphasizing the differing situations that the characters are in, and became a hallmark of the show.
The ocean will absorb a large portion of the radiation. However, prevailing winds would blow a moderate level of fallout back over the city of Los Angeles. Over time, there would be a high incidence of cancer and other radiation-related diseases.
But at least there'll be no immediate casualty.
We can't be certain, Mr. President. The shipping lanes into the port of Los Angeles are extremely busy. In the 80 square miles off the coast of L.A., the Coast Guard counts some 2 dozen freighters flying flags from around the world.
We're a little worried about this scene where they're discussing the options because it was a lot of dialogue. But I think the stakes are so high that I felt, anyway, that you really listened. You really wondered, my God, in this situation, what would you do? Where would you put that bomb to detonate? And I think people were drawn in because it's a heck of a dilemma.
And the fact that certainly in the city of Los Angeles, you're aware of the actual investment people have in these scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mr. President, would be devastating.
What about the desert?
We can designate a ground zero in the Mojave, sufficiently isolated so that inhabited areas won't be immediately affected. Local towns could be evacuated within hours of the blast without any serious long-term...
Well, I think good writing, you always have to balance the structure of the piece, which is the big picture, with the moments. And our show is built on taking moments that in most screen storytelling, TV and movies, would be gone through very quickly. We explode them. We take them and stretch them. And really put you inside them. And I think that's one of the ways you build tension.
And it's one of the luxuries of the 24 hours in the course of the season.
That's exactly right.
Because you can invest in minutia that you wouldn't be able to explore in an episode where you have to have a bad guy find him, tie a bow on by the end of an hour.
Yeah. Relatively small.
Sounds like the desert's our best option.
Yes, sir. We do agree with that.
But the continuity is always... very, very difficult to... you just have to make sure everything that happens makes sense in view of every single thing that's happened before. By the time you get up to episode... This is episode 15. By the time you get up into the teens and the 20s, so many balls in the air that we really need a lot of help, and everybody on the show participates in that. Cast, crew. We have just about everybody on the show one time or another has come up to one of the writers and said, hey, you know what? This guy can't have an orange pencil in this scene because he, you know, whatever it is. And we say, oh, you're right. And we go back and make it fit.
The masterminding of it reminds me of something over the past week. A friend of mine was describing that his uncle was a blindfolded chess champion.
No kidding. What was his uncle's name? Do you know?
I forget.
I'm a huge chess fan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we'll go into this
later. This guy could have 50 games going at once in his mind. And it, in a way, there's a similar sort of mental balancing, juggling that has to go on in getting all these different scenarios to interweave without conflicting.
No, that's exactly right. It's it does require everybody's attention. Very specific
coordinates. I'm sorry, Mr. President, but there isn't another way.
Do we know who the pilot will be?
We have a few volunteers, sir. All of them good men.
Writing this thing, I knew there would be three people that Jack would have to part from. Palmer, Kate, and his daughter Kim. And I realized I would be writing, in fact, three goodbye scenes. And in order to not make them repetitive, I had to come up with three different ways of people saying goodbye, not to mention the scene with George Mason, in which he says goodbye to him later on. So I decided Palmer... Jack would be heroic by not letting Palmer know he was flying the plane so they wouldn't have to say goodbye. And that's the way this one came about. And then you'll see Kate's goodbye in a second. And then Kim's, of course, is much different.
Right, George, if you blacked out and this plane went down before it got to the desert, a lot of people are going to die, and I know you don't want that.
Come on, Jack.
I know what you're trying to do. But I got to say no.
Agent Goodrich, this is Bauer. They chose the desert. I want you to clear airspace and start immediate evacuation now. Gentlemen! Load this bomb! We are a go!
From the beginning, Kiefer and I just had a good chemistry. We both came from a film background and approached things with a film realist, naturalistic point of view with an internal intensity to drive the scenes without forcing it in the acting. And so it's like speaking the same foreign language in television to be allowed to act on that level is a rare and welcomed gift. And so we felt that, and felt that sort of bonus of getting to work together from the start.
Now, when Xander first, we loved his work. We brought him on in the pilot as the kind of bad guy of that episode. And with no thought of, because the truth of the matter is, when we did the pilot, we didn't really have any great plan for the first season because it hadn't been ordered yet. But when we started getting into the later episodes, 4, 5, and 6, I can't remember exactly where you came back in, Xander, but we were looking for somebody for Jack to play off again, and we suddenly realized, why create a new character when Xander did such a great job as George Mason in the pilot? I'd love to see Jack Bauer come up against George Mason again. We all felt that way, so we brought Xander back for quite a few episodes in season one, and then this year there was no question that we wanted to make him a big part of the show.
And from my point of view, it was TV wasn't really on my radar, and the show sort of fell into my lap, and then I was just impressed as hell with how the thing turned out and the fact that I'd met my wife, who wasn't yet my wife.
That's right.
Sarah Clark is a series regular. Created an added incentive to want to come back on the show, and so
that's why you did a good job.
Yeah. Oh, okay. No, I mean, we just it was a great sort of confluence of forces drawing me back to the show, and I was always happy when I was brought back each time.
And that was the character. You did just a great job creating that character.
Well, it's interesting when you have to function as part of keeping the internal tension alive within the framework of the CTU and still be united on a certain level behind the same common enemy.
That's right. I think that's a really good point. I mean, one of the things, I said that Xander's character, George Mason, was the bad guy in the pilot, which he kind of was, but we ended up feeling it was much more interesting, as Xander just implied. Instead of having to be a bad guy, he's just a guy with a different point of view than Jack Bauer. They don't look at things the same way. In their own minds, they're both trying to accomplish the same thing. They're federal agents. They're serving their country. They're not evil people. They're not traitors. but they are going about things differently. They have completely different attitudes towards things. And it was wonderful because they were butting heads all the time. And yet underneath it, you didn't feel either one of them was evil or one-dimensional or a villain. It was more about how two tough-minded guys go about their jobs when they don't agree with each other on the methods.
And that's, again, I think comes back to the 24-hour structure, allowed us to explore the dimensionality of characters that so often get overlooked and swept aside as you race to tell the plot of a one-hour episode. And it's, a tremendous boon to be able to play a character that's like a real person, that has, you know, all sorts of paradoxes and contradictions going on within them, like all people do, but usually you've got a hero and you got a bad guy, and you're one or the other, and this allowed the dimensionality to start to be revealed gradually, and then in the second season, ever more so.
Yeah, and actually in the second season, George turned out to be heroic, kind of by default, but... He could have just gone off and felt sorry for himself, but he came back when he knew he was going to die. He came back and said, well, I'm going to accomplish something on the last day of my life.
And consistently throughout the season has remorse of conscience for a life not well lived and redeems himself and has a reckoning with his own flaws. Yeah. And so the audience gets to see that played out. So it's not just an arbitrary switch to, oh, he's good now.
Right. No, that's right. And as you said, that's part of the reason we could do that is because we stretch it out over... Many episodes.
Yeah. Great gift. I went from having a certain attitude towards television saying I could never get to do a character like this on film because you wouldn't have the time to explore the dimensionality. Yeah. And so it's a real gift.
This woman did a very good job in a small role.
She sure did.
It's a long story and I'm kind of in a little bit of trouble. If you happen to have a cell phone, I actually really need to make a phone call.
To whom?
And Kim just does
Kim's excellent.
An extraordinary job in this scene, too.
She's terrific.
It's great that you wrote this scene because she gets to deliver the goods that, as an actor, she redeems herself because she's been put in these circumstances that are a little bit far-fetched from time to time, and here's a very real one, and she just completely kicks it through the goalpost.
Absolutely. I thought, and as you say, some of the circumstances she was put in were a little stretched, and she did a great job. With those two.
She's absolutely.
Now here comes the second goodbye scene, which I also didn't want to have to write as a goodbye scene. So she's just finding out somebody's going, and oh my god, it's Jack.
So the pilot. Oh my god, who's it going to be?
Jack Bauer.
No, not Jack.
Oh, no. I was just starting to like him.
That's exactly. But he's got to go, so she would just give her enough time to realize what's going on. There's nothing he can say, nothing she can say. So that was goodbye scene number two, very short.
And again, this is a great example of how the guys that do the score for this show... fill in where you wouldn't want to see language, but they carry you emotionally through that moment.
Yeah, Sean Fowler does a great job, absolutely.
It's not heavy-handed at all, but it pulls your heart along through that moment.
Requesting immediate takeoff.
Roger that, Tower.
Thank you.
I think this is another example right here, just what we're looking at, where you can stretch things out a little bit. The motion is there and the tension is there, and we can just take our time in real time watching that plane taxi, turn around, taxi back down the runway, and up it goes.
And since you have the other two verbal goodbye scenes, the contrast with the nonverbal is perfectly filled by that.
Yeah.
Here's your preliminary draft of your statement tomorrow morning.
Yes. Right. Thank you.
How's the plane doing, Mike?
Mr. President, it's at 3,000 feet and climbing.
Out of the city yet?
No, sir. It's too soon for that, but they say they'll clear the main population centers in another 10 minutes.
One of the things we really want to do, because Dennis Haysbert and Kiefer play so well off each other, and they sort of form the two centers of the story, what's happening in CTU, what's happening in the bigger world, is to get them connected. And... sometimes they connect by talking to each other on the phone. Other times they connect because they're both concerned about the same thing. And we know David Palmer's whole thing is what's happening with the bomb, and Kiefer's flying the plane. So they're connected in some sense, even though they're not talking to each other. And in fact, Palmer doesn't even know, I think, it's either this scene or the next scene that he finds out that Jack's in the plane. But even before he finds out, there's that connection between them.
Mr. President. Sir, I do agree with Mike. Once word gets out that this bomb has gone off, there's bound to be a certain amount of civil unrest, and I don't think your administration should be associated with that.
I like scenes where, we've always liked scenes where Palmer ignores the advice he's getting, because it always makes him seem like a stronger, he makes his own mind up, he's not a, he doesn't put a finger to the wind, he really wants to do what he thinks is right. I think it makes him a stronger character. That's another example of it here.
Same is true with Jack, and I know experience in the first season, I was always the one that was elected to come up with an alternate point of view, and I always felt like my advice was never taken. It's hard to play that and keep it feeling like you have any intellectual authority.
Yeah, this is where he finds out right here. Yeah, just found out. Look, we did a great job, Dennis did.
Yeah.
Doesn't say a word, just you know what he's thinking.
He backs the truck up and moves.
Yeah. That's one of the things as a writer that this show has really taught me is to trust the actors. Because if you can do something with a look or body language, it's better, it's stronger, I think, often than dialogue. But you have to have the cast to do it. And we do. In fact, we find ourselves cutting lines because they're unnecessary often, because the actors have made the point by their looks, by their, you know, by their tone in the previous line or something.
That's a necessary part of the process, because you write it so the actor knows what needs to be said,
that's right,
what needs to be conveyed, and then you convey it through behavior, then you're always better off.
Exactly.
Cam?
Dad, finally. Oh, my God, are you okay?
I'm okay, sweetheart. Are you all right?
Yes, I'm fine.
Thank God.
Here's the goodbye scene, which I felt because the other ones were so truncated. The one with Palmer, where he doesn't even say goodbye to him, and then with Kate, which just with a look. So I felt here, okay, we can open it up a little and really let the emotion play. And of the three, this is the most emotional by far. Anyway, that's his daughter, and Alicia was wonderful.
Someone turned out to be me.
And this scene also, I think the emotion of this scene for longtime fans of the show was heightened by the mention of his wife, his dead wife. Because he says to his daughter, not only do I love you, but I want you to go on living and be someone your mother could be proud of. So that for people that watched the show last year and know that history, that line brings a little more emotion into it.
Else. You can't
Sweetheart,
do this
I
to
didn't
me,
have
Daddy.
Any other
no!
Choice. Kim, I need you to listen to me.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Sweetheart, what are you sorry for?
It was a natural reaction for the actress to say, you can't do this to me. And I think it's honest, because a kid or a young woman, you do feel things are being done to you. Obviously, it's not doing anything to her in one sense, but from her point of view, it is to her. And then later on in the scene, she comes around, realizes the bigger picture, and says, I'm so proud of you. And in that little bit, the actress was able to show some growth for her character, which I thought was a nice touch.
That's right.
Because I don't think, to me, was scripted.
I want you to try and grow up and be the kind of person that would have made your mom proud. Okay?
Oh, God.
Promise me that.
I promise.
Honey, I've got to start focusing on what I'm doing.
One of the things that we constantly know is that every scene's going to be shot, if possible, from the point of view of a character of ours. In other words, you see what they see. In an earlier scene, for example, when the plane took off, we showed the plane taking off, and then we showed Kate watching the plane taking off. And then we show Palmer finding out that Jack's on the plane. Everything's you try to put the audience as much as you can inside the mind and heart of the characters we have. Whether that influences the way we write, I'm sure it does in a certain way. It all becomes the language of the show. But we don't articulate it very often to ourselves. It's just something that, yeah, this works, yeah, this doesn't work.
I was certainly aware from an acting point of view of the creative interpenetration between the style of photography and editing and how that would inform the choices you made as an actor, just instinctively. And the camera on this, I've said over and over again, is like just one of the best camera crews I've ever gotten to work with, and I've worked with great film directors and cinematographers. It's something about Guy Skinner in particular as the primary camera operator, big guy, handheld camera, is able to play a scene as though he were one of the actors in it with the camera and follows the internal emotional essence of the scene in such an instinctive, intuitive way that he just moves with it and feeds you rather than taking you out by having a camera presence in the room. And knows exactly when to push him for the moments because he's memorized the dialogue. He's in the scene, and all of them are great. But I was just constantly aware of how that put me further into the scene, and I think it speaks to what you were talking about in terms of.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Xander, because Guy has a great story sense, and that's why he's able to put himself in the scenes. You know, for the writers, of course, you're telling a story. The director's telling a story, but so is everybody else. And the more anyone connected with the show, cast or crew, can feel the story and make themselves part of the story, so they're helping to tell the story, the better. And I think we've done very well, you know, with been very lucky and fortunate with the people we have, wardrobe and music and the makeup and every department, they're telling the story. They're not just doing their, they're telling the story. And there's a real sense on the show that people hook into the story that's being told and do their part of the job in a way that augments the bigger picture. And it's been a pleasure.
Northwest Regional. And again, what you're talking about in terms of how behavior can tell the story, the choices that you make in terms of the physicality and the business and working with props or whatever, is something that you're always confident that if you do some subtle minutia in behavior, that the camera will be on it and get it and use it to help tell the story, which liberates you from the usual talking head scenario of TV series that they can only tell the series tell the show by watching a face talking and telling you about it. And that's the agility of, and I think lucidity of, the camera movement and editing style that helps to facilitate that.
And how long will that be?
We should have initial confirmation within the hour, sir.
Let me ask you another question, Mr. Armin. Why would Syed Ali...
We're going into a scene soon, which is for me was the critical scene of the show, at least from the writer's point of view, which is when Xander turns out to be in the plane with Jack. And I think there were some people who were... I don't think anybody thought Jack was going to die. But some people thought the bomb wouldn't go off. Some people thought there would be somebody else in the plane who doesn't. And some people figured it would be George Mason, which is fine, because I never felt the point was the surprise. I think the point is what happens between the two of them once George emerges from the back seat. Getting a little ahead of myself here, but it's coming up.
The last you've seen me, it's been the classic George-Jack exchange where I've had...
You lose.
...a point of view that's juxtaposed against his, and his wins out.
Yeah.
And I seem disappointed, defeated, and all the more so because I can't sacrifice myself for a worthy cause and somehow redeem my own death.
Right.
And the frustration that he's going to kill himself unnecessarily, and I'm going to die a wasted death.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think you played it absolutely as well as could be played. But people that watch the show are looking for the twist and the turn, and they're going to get... I mean, we have things... Everything is guessed. Some things that we do are guessed in advance, and a lot of things we don't do are guessed in advance. Some people I know guessed that George would be in there, but I always felt, so what?
It's a good opening line.
Can you change my coordinates? Negative. They're confirmed as given.
Because the point of the scene is what happens after he comes out, not that he was there. Because one thing about, you know, we've never really delved, nobody's ever called Jack on his.
Yeah, this is the one scene where.
Yeah. And
I got to win the argument.
Yeah, exactly. You had to pay the price of dying for it, yeah. But it was worth it.
It was worth it, yeah. Absolutely.
Hey, service is bad enough on this flight. You don't have to shoot me.
George, what the hell are you doing here?
Felt like taking a ride.
And now he asks Jack, I think, the essential question that his character has never been asked, which is, do you want to live or do you want to die? The way you live your life, you don't pay attention to authority, you take chances, you take risks. You have a death wish? Is that the easy way out for you, or do you want to live? For you, it might be easier to die. I, George Mason, I don't have a choice, but you do. What's your choice? And to me, that was the heart of the scene and the heart of this episode. In a way, it's the heart of our show. Who is Jack Bauer in the character sense? And to me, these two guys just hit it out of the park and out of the county. I just thought this scene, certainly it played as well as I ever imagined it could. I mean, they did everything. They got everything out of the writing that they could have gotten out of it. Maybe it could have been written better, but it couldn't have been acted better.
This probably doesn't look like such a bad idea. Get to go out in a blaze of glory, one of the greatest heroes of all time. Leave your troubles behind. This could be the easy way out, huh? You still got a life, Jack. You want to be a real hero? Here's what you do.
And it's unarguable, the logic
right.
That I'm presenting. We are out of harm's way. He does not need to be there. The only thing compelling him to stay there is his death wish, because he's escaping. And the fact of the matter is, the brave and heroic thing for him to do is to get the hell out of the plane and get back to a daughter that needs him.
Yeah.
And a country.
Come on, Jack. You got 12 minutes.
And Xander had a fine line to walk here, because he had to win this argument and convince Jack and the audience that he can, in fact, complete this mission. But at the same time, he's right on the verge of death. So he can't look too healthy. He can't look too spry. But on the other hand, he's got to be strong enough mentally and physically so that Jack is justified in jumping out of the plane. He does a good job. You can see it's a struggle, but he's going to do it.
And this airspeed. The second the LAD reads a minute and a half, you initiate a dive at a 30-degree angle.
Wouldn't that get me in a little early?
That's the point. You have to be absolutely certain that the bomb is already in the depression before it goes off.
I got it.
Yeah, I got a lot of calls on that. Like, they did a great job with your makeup. And I was like, just messages on the voicemail.
It's a second career there, if you
know. Yeah. I've always enjoyed doing it.
Thank you.
These two guys have been at odds, for a year and a half or more. And now at this moment, two people will never be more intimately connected emotionally, in a sense, than these two guys are right now, which is one. I think, again, hopefully people that just sat down and watched the show like the show. People that have followed it for a year and a half, I think a scene like this really resonates with them, because these are two people they know in a TV sense very well.
Yeah. And I think you did a skillful job throughout the whole two seasons of negotiating moments within that relationship where they were on the same page and where they had mutual respect, and then slammed back into conflict.
Yeah, I think it's almost like, in a sense, it's almost like a marriage, where there's times when it's great and there's times when we don't kill each other, but you're stuck with each other, and that's what these two guys have.
I don't know what it's like just sitting in there and watching you guys go through the editing process, but I imagine as co-creators and collaborators from the writing point of view, it's advantageous to have different points of view, because it's through that conflict that you come up with the best idea.
No question about it.
And
that's absolutely,
I think that
right.
That's certainly a part of all. And then the relationship between male and male ego and competitiveness. It's a part of every workplace.
That's true.
Between men that are smart and good at what they do. And it helps them be better at what they do.
Yeah, that's right.
And yet gets dirty sometimes. And it never did in The Office while I was, by the way. It was always very clean and
yes,
very well managed. But
well, you feel strongly about things, and you know, that's the way it should be. If people don't care, they shouldn't be here. So you're right. That's right. Absolutely right.
And that's part of the, again, this is nice to get to reveal truths instead of these reinforcing fantasies about cliches and stereotypes that people are black or white and not, sorry.
Not racially, but yeah, no, yeah, racially.
That it's dimensionality that's so refreshing, I think, on television. And I certainly get from the response I've gotten from people out in the world about the show and about the character, they enjoyed that aspect.
Yeah.
And I certainly did as an actor.
Discussing the matter of retaliation.
Go on.
Yes, sir. Up to now, the Joint Chiefs have been assuming the bomb was the work of a terrorist group called Second Wave. Now it appears Second Wave.
The show is virtually without humor, truthfully. I don't think we are as people, but the show is what it is. It has a life of its own, and there's very little humor in it. But Xander's, I guess, is, I don't know if it's his personality, his acting style, or just he just found a way of delivering lines that we just said, you know, we've got to take advantage of that. And he's the only guy that ever gets laughs on the show. That's just the way it happened. Cynical, caustic.
There was something in the opening, in the pilot, that the guy, to me, I thought, how can I make this guy different from just a bad guy?
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, well, he has a different agenda, and he's a little jaded and a little cynical, and he doesn't see eye to eye with this guy's approach. He's a protocol man, but he also does what he has to do to be a team player, and so it's a whole thing that's at odds. And so to play into it with a sarcastic sense of humor gave it a feeling of truth to me to play, rather than just being bad, to be mean, you know, which doesn't feel real.
No, it worked great, and I think it did cause us to write to it more than we would have thought we would have.
I think I told you early on, my sister, after seeing the first the pilot episode, maybe the first couple episodes where I came back, said, they got to bring a character back. They need the gravitas and wit. It just adds the right flavor to the show. And
no, it's been good.
Is there anything you want me to take care of?
I don't know what we're going to do for that now that we nuked you.
I got pretty much squared away. You got to spend a little time with my son.
I didn't even know you had one. Glad you got to see him.
Yeah, me too.
There's a big theme in the show, fathers and children. It's something that with Palmer and Jack and Xander and the whole Warner family this year, it's something we're constantly playing with, the different kinds of relationships you can have. And I think that it's not in this episode, but the scene you had with your son was wonderful.
It was good to reference it. We did a thing where we took the wallet out, where I had his number that I'd done in the scene before, to try and play that moment I started to take the paper out to give him the number, and then I realized I don't need the wallet anymore, so I gave him the wallet. And
right.
It felt really right at the time, but for the time together, they had to lose that moment. But it was
That was a good moment. And now from this time on, of course, everything's pointed toward the bomb. Again, from all the different points of view, you're going to see the president, of course, Jack, George and Kim, or it's all about the bomb. And I guess at this point, people watching realize, man, these guys are actually going to set this bomb off. But I know when the episode started, certainly when the season started, and I think even when the episode started, nobody really believed the bomb would go off, because it's the one thing you can't do. You can't do that. But I think we found a way of doing it that it shows you what a horrible thing it would be without being so horrifying that you can't stand to watch it. Which I think if it went off in L.A. would have been the case.
Now, you knew you were killing me off from the beginning of the season. That was something we were all on the same page about. And you didn't know when exactly, and you didn't know when you were going to get rid of the bomb. And you were aware that both storylines were playing themselves out, because there's something a little bit depressing about watching somebody gradually decay to the point of...
Yeah, complete.
You know, and so it was a perfect... again, confluence of two storylines to be able to...
Yeah, I agree. I remember the day we thought of it. I don't remember exactly when it was, but it was after the season was underway. I mean, we were we were working things out. It just seemed like you said, it works. And it redeems the... I mean, it doesn't make the bomb be just a shock. There's an emotional aspect to it that's, you know, that makes it mean something.
Yeah. We've had a lot of people thank me for this, Bob, for saving Los Angeles.
Yeah. And other people will blame you for it.
Yeah, well. But it was interesting because I hadn't known when, and I'd plotted in my mind as a makeup artist and an actor, how the gradual metamorphosis would occur, having done the research. And so that time that I stopped in the office, I said, so when exactly?
Yeah, I remember that, said, yeah.
And that was where it was like, there's good news and there's bad news. It's sooner than we thought, but it's in a great way.
Yeah.
And so I went, oh, well, then I have to race to this conclusion that I think the audience needs and wants to see in the way of the external manifestation. Because they established in the beginning there's a 12-hour incubation period that's relatively symptom-free. And so then between 12-hour and 15-hour, we had to quickly get to that point, and maybe a little bit more abruptly than would have been ideal, but it was perfect the way it coincided with this storyline with the bomb.
And plus, those things are not, you know, set in stone. I mean, everybody's going to react differently, and
yeah, of course.
You know, so it's, I think you can have some legitimate room to wiggle there.
I know Joel didn't want to see it looking too macabre in the face. And we waited until just this episode to take it to that place. And I think it plays realistically from where it came before.
Yeah, very much so.
There's two things that work simultaneously that I always thought was amusing with the show, in that by the end of a season, you're almost a year older than you were at the beginning of the season, and it's the same day. But the way in which it works is that you've been up for 24 hours, so you look a year older. So from beautiful downtown Canoga Park, this is Andy Berkeley, is George Mason, and
Bob Cochran, executive producer, co-creator. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.